Hello, this is Neil Shep, and you're listening to the Don't Do That, Do This podcast, the show that shares inspiring and actionable growth stories in the Middle East, brought to you by the British Chamber of Commerce Dubai. Today, we're talking about taking risks, launching and growing a business in Dubai with Chris and Amanda Redmond, who along with a few other businesses runs Redhole. Redhole is a global recruitment agency offering expert search and advisory services. We're also joined here by Katie Holmes, who is the General Manager for the British Chamber of Commerce Dubai.
Thank you, Neil. Really excited about this first episode. We can't do this without you, though, so please subscribe. Do follow us on social media and be the first to know when a new episode comes out. And enjoy. If you think that you have an idea or a story that would be great on the podcast for Neil and I to interview you, please let us know. And equally, if there's somebody that out there that you think would be a great subject, we would love to hear from you, and we'll do our best to get them on the podcast.
This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the following teams: Rightfully for storytelling and thought leadership, Studio Red for the quality podcast studio and video production, and Sherbet Lemon for branding, social media design, and editing. Welcome to the Don't Do This, Do That podcast. We have Chris and Amanda Redmond. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Good to see you, Katie.
Good to see you. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to this. So look, we've got loads of questions to help entrepreneurs and small businesses take their business to the next level. But let's start here. What's your favourite biscuit?
Shall I start?
Yeah, you can start.
Okay, my favourite biscuit has got to be the world-renowned Jammy Dodger. You want to know the reason why?
Definitely.
Okay, so Jammy Dodgers, when you asked us this question before coming here today, I didn't have to think about it for very long before thinking Jammy Dodgers are my favourite because they remind me of my nan. I spent a lot of time with my nan growing up. I was her first grandson. I was born on her birthday, so we both share the same birthday. And without a doubt, whenever I went to my nan's house, she was like this 4 foot nothing little Irish lady. And whenever I went to her house, it was open peanut butter sandwiches. I don't know why she didn't put two slices of toast. It was always an open peanut butter sandwich and Jammy Dodgers. What a mix. So Jammy Dodgers for me, if I ever walk into a meeting room and there's Jammy Dodgers on the table, like there is now, definitely that's the first thing that attracts my eye.
Love it. Love it. What about you, Amanda?
So I'm a little bit boring. I don't eat biscuits at all. I guess I'm kind of the opposite. I grew up in a household where chocolate and biscuits weren't really the thing. It was a bit more healthy. Had to eat fruit. So, yeah, a bit boring. Don't really eat biscuits. Sorry, I haven't got a great answer there.
All right, so we'll have to move that plate towards Chris then. Yeah.
Well, you can move. You probably shouldn't move it towards me actually, because I'll definitely consume them. They'll be safe with Amanda. Let's put them on Amanda's side of the table.
Kate, you like a Jammy Dodger?
I'm partial to a Jammy Dodger. Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for sharing that story, though. That's part of this podcast, is to kind of understand exactly the memories that are associated with why you would choose that as your favourite biscuit. So thank you for sharing.
There you go.
Special memories.
So, Ellie Redmond. Just to start off, tell us about Redhole Recruitment.
Okay, so Redhole came from the birthplace of Redhole, the nucleus of our proposition, is from the chapter of my career before I was in recruitment. You know, I worked in telecoms for years and years, worked my way up to a senior level group director, an organization called Colt, which at the time was a 1.4 billion euro revenue line. 40% of our clients were trading floors across Europe, Deutsche Börse, Italiana Börse, London Stock Exchange. And I hired lots of people, loads and loads of people. We were fortunate in that we were owned by Fidelity as a venture capital company, and they trained managers into how to interview well and how to counteroffer well when someone was resigning. But I also experienced what it was like to interface to the external market when I was working with agencies, and it was always painful. So when I came into the recruitment chapter of my career, I was able to recycle some of that experience on how to be empathetic towards whoever is on the client side of the table. And that's really where our whole methodology and how forensic we are and the technology we use to try and care for the hiring manager's time has come from.
And is your policy to wear red because you've failed in that today?
Red Holt came from the fact that Amanda's surname was Holt and mine's Redmond. And when we were building the business, one of your friends, Sam, I think we were at a brunch or lunch or something with them, and we were like, oh, I don't know what to call this business, you know, Zenith or crazy, you know, all these crazy ideas you have, trying to think of what's the Greek for recruitment or whatever. and Sam went, why don't you call it Red Holt? We were like, yeah, that actually works.
Amazing. So, I love it. Thanks for making the effort today then with the red.
What were you doing before, Amanda, before you joined?
So started Red Holt? I left sixth form and I want to just earn money, so made it to the big city of London and joined recruitment when I was 18. So I'm 17 years in now. So quite a
she's a thoroughbred
recruiter. Yeah, mine and Chrissy's career history is so different, but it's worked really well.
And what's your roles?
So Chris can talk for himself, but I effectively lead delivery, operations, finance, and Chris does everything else.
We're the yin and the yang of each other when it comes to the business side. You know, Amanda's not just business, actually life. Yeah. I think we're total opposites in so many ways. You know, I'm very free-spirited, creative. I love it when I've got an empty diary and I can just look at my day and go, cool, what do I want to do today? That would be Amanda's version of a nightmare day. Like, oh, no structure. I'm like, this is a dream day. But I run all of the strategy, marketing and business development, all the sales side. So it works really well. And we're at a stage now as well where it's really important after being eight years in and, you know, a very, very healthy turnover as a business. The next chapter of our growth as a business is really about creating scale and structure and being able to aggregate what we both bring as individuals into something that's more formalized for the value of the business with hopefully some form of transaction within the next 5 years.
Mm. And as a previous project manager for 10 years, I love structure and I can't work without structure. But I love a good Excel sheet, you know? And there's many people in business who are great at their business, they're experts in their space, but you ask them to plan a roadmap and it's all over the place, right? So Amanda, what tips would you share around structuring your week, structuring your day? How do you make sure you're making sure Chris the unstructured is happy with the revenue side and the growth, but then you're also making sure everything's aligned?
So for me, I have a to-do list that I physically write down. I'm still a pen and paper kind of girl. I write my to-do list every day, and whatever isn't completed rolls over to the next day. And I feel that putting everything in the diary is key, especially with Chris, my wild child, who, you know, he's here, there and everywhere. I'm very much, I can go to a desk and work at a desk all day. Chris will be in four or five different locations throughout. So, putting everything in the diary, making sure you've got enough time allowed to talk about the subjects that you need to talk about. So organisation is absolutely key for me.
With such different skill sets, obviously it seems to be working very well. When you're recruiting for Red Holt, how does that work in the interview process when you see something in somebody that you like and maybe the other one doesn't?
It's a great question. I think we've changed and evolved our interview process throughout for that exact reason. We've got trusted people in the business that we also lean on for their opinion. It's quite interesting. Some of them are mini me's and some of them are mini Chris's. So you do get the, we like this person for this reason, we like them for that. But we tend to find we'll just meet in the middle if we differ on opinions and you know, hope for the best.
I'm not sure we do always meet in the middle. I actually think... I actually think we've part of that evolution that Amanda's just alluded to is that we've learned to respect what each other brings. If Amanda puts her foot down and says, no, Chris, this person is not good because, I've learned to respect that because ultimately I've got the battle scar associated to what the implications of that are further down the line. You know, and I think Amanda does the same for me. You know, if I really want to advocate someone as bringing tangible benefit to the business for whatever reason, I feel as though we have quite healthy conversations, not only around why do you think that and really trying to empathise with each other's perspective, but then also ultimately where the weighting lies in terms of the decision. You know, if it's too much risk, even if I feel too passionate about it or if Amanda does, I think mutually we do that. And I also think we've got a really good leadership team that are not scared to pipe up when it comes to hearing what we need to hear.
I think as well, depending on where this person's going in the business, if they're falling into delivery, I would probably have a stronger opinion, if you like. And if they're falling under sales or marketing, Chris would probably have the overall decision. But typically, we'll try and meet in the middle.
Got it. So talking about wild childs, you've done the impossible. You're married, you've got 2 kids, 2 and 4, and you work in the business together. How does that work?
I actually think that's one of the reasons that we've been able to be so successful within, you know, less than 10 years. Red Holt's been going for 8 years. As you know, we've got other businesses as well, both together and separate business interests. Amanda's also on the board of a champagne company. And I actually think part of the reason it works is because we get like 3 working days out of everyone's normal day. You know, like if you were to split it into shifts, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed, don't get me wrong, we're not business bores. We do a lot of cool stuff. But we're always kind of weaving dialogue into our interactions throughout the course of today, every day, to help our business. And that allows us to move forward really quickly because we don't need to book a meeting room with each other. We're talking about what's happening while we're taking the kids to school. You know, it's always on the go.
So I remember with my wife when I introduced her to the business. We both quit investment banking and I introduced her. I said, hey, I need your help. And then she would sit next to me in the office and I'd say, hey, could I get some help with this? And she'd be like, can't you do it? And I'll be like, and that's not how it's meant to work. And over the next few weeks and months, it got to the point where we wanted to kill each other. So our policy, actually, Dibner helps us in the business, but our policy is we can't be in the same office. And it works. It's great. But tell me the bad side. Tell me the struggle. Because managing 2 kids, Dubai's slightly easier from a lifestyle perspective, for sure. But what's the bit that, it's really hard.
It is hard, and I would say it's great that Chris and I can be walking around Dubai Hills Park and the kids are playing, but we are talking about work. Oh, what about this? Why haven't we picked this up with this client? Oh, we've got a new role coming in next week. There's no off button, which sometimes just does get a bit too much. Sometimes we've had to book dinner in the diary to actually spend time with each other. No Red Holt chat. 20 minutes in, we start chatting about Red Holt. It never, ever has lasted, I don't think. And, you know, we work, as I was telling you earlier, around the clock. We're doing roles in New Zealand, Australia, Middle East, Europe, right through to New York, America, Canada. So we're still working at 10, 11 o'clock at night most nights. So I'd say that's where, for me, the main struggle is. Missing that time with the kids as well. We try and do morning drop-off and pick-up every day just to make sure we're around. But when it's bedtime, I'll try my best to be there, but if I have a meeting with New York, because they're coming online, sometimes you do miss out.
Just a quick question on that. So obviously you've relatively recently moved from the UK to Dubai. How are you finding your support structure with the kids? Is it easier now, or what were your kind of challenges in moving them with the business to here?
I would say we're extremely lucky. My sister lives here and Chris's brother lives here. So we have an amazing family set up already. I find that I've spoke to a lot of my friends. They don't have that social security or social system here. But, you know, it's making new friends. It's going to a new school. It's learning about how Dubai works, how crazy the roads are, you know, all of that stuff. So it can be a bit daunting sometimes, but...
Do you know, one of the things I love about Dubai, Katie, is, you know, we've got a population of 3 million. 85% of those people are expats. And that's a mass. That's unique, I think, globally on the planet. And it means to me that 85% of the people in any room, in any place, in any bar, at school when you're doing job, have also got the same problems as you. Right? They've all moved here. They've all got families. The complexion of their life has got similarities to you. And they've all moved here for a reason, for a purpose. And I actually think that the recognition of that point is quite liberating in terms of how confident it allows you to feel to make friends and to communicate with people, because the chances are they've got the same agenda as you. And I think that it means you get this cohesion socially where people want to help each other. You know, they want to collaborate, not just from a business perspective, but just to have a network. We've got some brilliant friends now. I'd say some of the best friends that we've ever had just from bumping into them at school or here or there. Or I think if you just dial up a little bit on your confidence to interact with people, and I mean only a little bit, it can have a disproportionately beneficial impact.
Yeah, it's a good filter, I would say. People that hear, like you say, that you're shared goals as well. Yeah. And how do you, like, beyond meeting people at the school gates, have you extended your network, like your business network? What have you been doing in terms
Absolutely.
Of that?
Yeah, well, from a business perspective, I am a bit like Neo in the Matrix when he sees ones and zeros everywhere. I in Dubai, I just see opportunity everywhere. Like, you know, we're here at Studio Red today. This was a business opportunity for me to make this. Amazing, let's do it, just go for it. You know, there's a number of other things I've set up. Red Hole AI as well is another business that we've set up since being here. But what I find is that actually Amanda has to dial me back on starting a new business every week out here, because I could. You know, and I, again, I feel as though it's because the air smells of ambition in Dubai.
I mean, we met a few weeks ago. Yeah. A week later, we're sitting down having a collaboration chat at your pool.
Yeah, absolutely. I find that, again, it's part of what I love about this chapter of my life and being here, Katie, is being around like-minded, entrepreneurial, interesting, ambitious business people. And Dubai's packed full of them.
I do feel like people are so welcome to ideas here, maybe less so anywhere else in the world. Even here, we've been invited to a recruitment network, and we meet once a month and we collaborate on ideas. That would not happen in the UK. Everyone sees each other as an enemy. We do not share ideas. We're, competitors.
More guarded.
Here, it's quite nice. Everybody meets and talks about what's going on. So I do feel like it's a nice place to meet up, and coffees and drinks and stuff to collaborate.
I think people really enjoy passing connections on as well, because it's with pure intentions that you're recommending somebody because you've had a good experience. And then ultimately, in our experience anyway, the best networkers are those going into a room thinking, how can I help somebody else, rather than what's in it for me?
You know, I think there's two sides to it as well, Katie, just listening to my own thoughts. Everything we're talking about is more that organic side, which has got quite a depth when it comes to authenticity. But I do remember one of the first things that somebody said to me when we moved out here was, you need to join British Business Group. And then, you know, because of my relationship with James Kahn and helping to set up Recruitment Entrepreneur here, literally that day that I spent with James coaching him, we went to the LinkedIn offices, then we went somewhere else, and then we came over to SLS on the rooftop. I think that was British Business Group that arranged that, actually. And, you know, it's like BBG is kind of one of the more structured and more well-established and credible, I think, bodies here. And I think if you can get that clutch control between having your own things and being tapped into something like British Business Group, then you get the full traction when it comes to rapidly developing your network of contacts and friends.
Thank you.
Maybe
nice plug.
Yeah, maybe we could get James Kahn on the podcast.
Yeah, well, I speak to James regularly. So.
He doesn't have to wear red, though. It's fine, unless he wants to. So there's, just to go into that a bit further, so there's, I feel like there's a lot of businesses looking at Dubai, the potential, MENA as a region, Saudi. I'm often getting messages on Instagram going, Neil, I want to move to Dubai, I want to set up, where do I...
Get those all the time, right?
Yeah. And where do I set up? How do I go about it? Is there potential? What would you say to someone that is thinking about expanding their business to this region, knowing what you know, from a family perspective? Because, you know, let's be honest, it's not cheap. Right?
It's really expensive.
And you talk about calculated risks in the pre-interview, taking risks, but taking calculated risks. So what would you say to that person who has a family, but also has the ambitions to come across to this region and expand?
You want to go first?
I feel like you need to be coming for the right reasons. And I think you need to understand that in the short term, you've got to stump a lot of cash to get your licenses, to get your visas, to get your medical. If you're going to put your children into a great school, you know, you're going to drop a lot of money. Your car, your rent isn't, you pay monthly, you know, you pay over a certain amount of checks. I would recommend doing the due diligence first rather than just jumping straight into it. But, you know, we learned that, and I don't regret coming, but the cost is definitely a massive upfront cost.
It's bigger than we thought it was going to be. Definitely. You know, much bigger, I would think.
I think one of the things as well, where we are classed as self-employed, you know, you don't get a lot of credit assistance. So we had to go and buy our car cash. I didn't know that until we got here. Maybe a mistake, you know, you learn lessons in life, but you have to find the cash to get a car and you have to pay your rent and you have to pay your school fees. And you're like, wow, I could have just put a deposit down on a flat. but, you know.
Yeah, it hurts, doesn't it?
It hurts. Yeah. It hurts the heart a little bit. But yeah, that's the only thing I'd really say. Just do your due diligence on costs.
Have you kept a presence back in the UK?
Yeah, we've still got our businesses back in the UK.
Yeah, still got a house. I just can't let go of it at the moment. I love our house in the UK, but the aim is to stay here, so maybe one day we'll...
So here's a good example of where me and Amanda are really different, right?
You want to sell?
Yeah, so, no. Well, yeah, actually.
I can tell.
I'd sell that house.
Yeah.
I'd sell that house. I can tell from your reaction. I'd release the equity and
I'd get
something out here, because that's all Amanda talks to me about, is getting an amazing villa here. I'm like, well, all the cash is sitting in that bricks and mortar in the UK. But, you know, but the difference, I think, between us, all of the things that Amanda's just mentioned, you know, all that cash outlay, and there was tens of thousands going out when we first moved here, that excites me. You know, it's that... Gordon Ramsay talked about it recently on the High Performance podcast, Jeopardy, he called it. You know, when there's skin in the game and there's something to be done, it's like, if I put this much down, how much could I get back? You know, that attracts me.
This is
I
the like yin that. And the yang, as you're talking.
But that's the texture that I like in my life, you know, that I like the feeling of that. Because, yeah, it's like, okay, let's do it. But life's too short to... I've got a saying, if you don't risk anything, you risk more. You know, if you want to just stay on the track, fine, but expect a boring view. Get off track, you know, go and do something exciting. Go and do something that other people won't do. So for me, the piece of advice that I would give people about moving to Dubai would be just be aware of the fact that it's a yes economy when it comes to getting meetings. Everyone will meet you in Dubai. You won't struggle to get meetings in Dubai. You will have to focus on converting those meetings into business. Whereas in the UK, it's the inverse of that. It's harder to get a meeting, but if you get the meeting, people will have a more sincere motivation, so you're more likely to convert. It's the opposite here.
Relationships are really key, and not
Absolutely.
Just in Dubai, but throughout the whole GCC. And that's exactly that. It's a lot of, it can take a year, but it's making sure it's that face time, the consistency, and then it's worth it.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And having the patience to bear with relationships as well. Some of our best clients... We didn't actually move to Dubai to do business. That was not our motivation. We moved here for our boys, for a lifestyle. Yeah, absolutely. We saw some things in the UK that made us feel adverse about what was happening in the short, medium, and for me, long term. I think a lot of the problems in the UK would take a long time to address. So we did not move here for business purposes. That was not our intention.
That would be my assumption.
No, absolutely not. But I guess because of some of the gravity of the way we are and the way we network, and it, business came to us. And then I was like, I quite like this. This is quite good. And
let's go
with the avalanche. So our motivations were personal. And my personal motivation was not just the boys. I lecture on MBA courses as well. And I really like doing that. And the main campus I lecture on is here in Dubai. So... longer term, that's my plan, is to go full-time lecturing. And
Professor Chris.
Yeah. Professor Chris,
he's
maybe. Who knows?
Deal with the whole of Red Hole, and he's going to go.
Yeah, I'm going to leave Amanda with the empire.
I think you're fine. Yeah, it's
like, she'll probably be glad.
Yeah. You'd be like, thumbs up.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Bye. Yeah.
But so earlier, you were talking about loads of meetings, and it's easy to get a meeting, but it's hard to convert, and completely agree. But here we're talking about qualification, right? The importance of qualifying the meeting. So talk about that. How do you make sure that you're having the right meeting? What's your thinking? What's your mindset behind that?
What you need to appreciate in the response I'm going to give you, Neil, is that my philosophy is that I will generally engineer opportunity from lots of situations. It's not so much about pre-qualification for me. It's about... making sure you get traction from the meeting. So whatever jurisdiction you're in, wherever you are globally, follow up, follow up, follow up. You know, so I've got a rule of 7 follow-ups. Nothing's going to happen with 1 follow-up. Keep following up, keep following up, keep following up. But so for me, it's about making sure when you get that meeting that you're more actively listening than talking, and then making sure that in however you interpret the material you get, that you're doing something with it, like do something with it. Personally, I'll go to most meetings. Because you always learn something. You always learn something at an interaction with another human about yourself or them or the situation. It's about what you do with it afterwards. So I get what you're saying about qualification, but for me, it's actually about what am I going to do with the gift that I've just been given? Yeah, I've now got something. How creative can I be? How driven can I be? What can I do with what you've just given me? How compelling can I be to you to make you love me and what I've got to offer you because of what you just told me?
Yeah, I really like that. A friend of mine says, no meeting, no coffee is too small. And you never know. I've had so many meetings. I'll often have someone message me, hey, could we have a coffee? And I have no idea where that's going. But I've always got this phrase in the back of my head, despite how many meetings are in my calendar, and I'm actually trying to reduce my meetings. But suddenly something will come up. It's like when we met. I had no idea where that was going. We were just meeting to do the pre-interview for the podcast. So great, love the answer.
I have a quick question just on that.
Yeah?
So obviously you're a real giver of your time. But at what point, how do you manage when you feel your instinct and there's a red flag of somebody taking too much of your time and you know it's not going to go anywhere else? Like, what? How do you manage that?
Just use your tact and diplomacy to chop it off. You know, I think that the... and I'm quite brutal about that in a soft way. If I do get an intuition before I meet someone, or if they're asking for a meeting and I'm like, this is... I'm not just wasting my time, I'm actually wasting theirs. And I think it makes me feel disingenuous when I sit with someone and I know I've got nothing to offer them. I hate sitting in meetings like that. And if I'd have known before, it's like, you know, life is so short. And even if I spend an hour with someone that I knew before I wasn't going to be able to offer something to, that why would you do that? That's a waste of life. But then if I thought there was going to be something and I meet them and then there is nothing, I will tactfully and diplomatically stand back from that. You know, I don't like hurting people's feelings. I don't like the style of business where people are rude and obnoxious to each other. I've got no time for it. And if someone's like that with me, it just tells me more about their values than mine, to be honest with you. So I just think you have to know when to put your foot down and when to go, this is not going anywhere.
I've definitely got that problem. Yeah. I can have a meeting and feel really bad to cut it off and it end up being a 2-hour conversation and I'll be like,
I've interviewed people before, Neil, where I've known within the first half an hour that they're not the right person for the job. And I know some people will hear this and go, well, if you've booked an hour meeting, you should interview someone for an hour. If I know that person's not going to be right, I trust my intuition. I trust where the conversation's going. I make sure that I'd have evidence-based responses if they said, why do you think that? But I remember one day going all the way to Finland when I was working in Stockholm to interview someone with Maria, the lady that was HR director. Half an hour into the meeting, I said, look, I don't think there's going to be a marriage at the end of this courting ritual that we're going through. I need to tell you that I don't think you're the right person for this job. That he asked me why, he's a Russian guy. He asked me why and I told him why and he went, yeah, I probably agree with you. So you know, I think that having a bit of conviction sometimes when you get that intuition, you can actually create real value in the interaction by being authentic about how you're feeling. And you can do it in the moment, but again, it's about how you say something, not what you say.
And I'm just wondering, actually, if you could talk a little bit about the AI element, whether that can short circuit so that you avoid those
Absolutely.
Long, complicated interviews.
So we've gone 25 minutes, maybe, without talking about AI. So I was wondering how, at what point it was going to turn up.
Yeah, it's not a real podcast if you don't
talk about AI. Exactly.
So about 3 or 4 years ago, I went to Amanda with one of my crazy ideas. I went, look, I think we should start using AI. You can do AI-based psychometric evaluations of people. They don't know you're doing them. It checks data points in the internet about them, and it builds a picture of what their psychometric characteristics are. Amanda's like, what the hell are you talking about now? So I showed her, I got it, and I was like, we should use this for when we're headhunting people. We can map out not only what their professional competencies are, but also what their psychometric proclivities are. And all of that you can triangulate into what your client has asked you to find. You can also use it when you're reaching out to that candidate to say, we know you better than you think we do, and we need to validate and legitimize this profile we've got. So we've been using AI successfully for the last 3 years in our business. We use it on every single search. I've actually now worked with the company that produced that to make my own AI-based company. We've got the exclusive rights for the UAE to sell that product. That's really helpful to people. You know, you said I'm quite generous with my time. When people are looking for a job, I always talk to them. Because if I can't find them a job, the least I can do is take them through their profile. And that helps them. And I say, look, use this. Look for jobs that stimulate your energizers. Avoid companies that have got a culture that will accentuate your drainers. And it helps them. And what goes around comes around.
I remember years ago, I was on a training course, and it was, you know, as a child, you're brought up to believe, treat others how you would like to be treated. Yeah. And this training course was treat others how they want to be treated. So there was an element of, I think it was Myers-Briggs, which is, you know, real old school now. But it was really understanding in financial services, for me particularly, to go into an office with somebody that was a, you know, red or an A or whatever our company was, how to present information to them to get what I wanted. It was so I can imagine this is on, sounds like, on a very, very deep level.
It's really powerful. It's profound. And I think using it comes with a degree of responsibility. I've had two. So we've done this to thousands of people all over the world. I can remember only two instances where people have pushed back and gone, that's not right. How did you get it? You know, and I see that reaction. I'm like, I know how you feel. This is what I'm thinking. I know how you feel. You feel violated. That's how they feel. But I quite like it when people do that, because I say, let's go through it together. And on both instances, it was a North American, very successful white male that had pushed back quite aggressively and been very volatile. And you know what? I knew why they'd done it, and I predicted it, because they're a red. They were 90% red. It's an absolute red response. And the funny thing is, I'm still in touch with both of those guys. When I had taken them through it, they're both like, it's right, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, you reacted like a red.
There you go. Talking about recruitment, so we went to the BBG audience membership and we asked them to give us some questions. So we've got a question from Monica Mahi. Ready? What is the future of the expat workforce in the UAE in the coming years?
It's a good question.
It's a great question. I've got an idea to kick us off on that.
Go for it.
So, you know, I think that... Now, Dubai's been going for 50 years, right? It's this incredible social experiment that we all live in. And understandably, there's adjustments that the scientists will want to make to their experiment as it unfolds. And one of those now is emiratization, where Emiratis should have the same opportunities as expats have had in the building of what this has become. And I actually think that's going to start to balance the landscape when it comes to the future for expats in terms of coming. I can already feel it. You know, we're in the recruitment market here, and that conversation is one that happens with most of my clients, if not all of them, if not when we're doing an assignment, but generally in the dialogue that I have with them. It's something that especially bigger employers legally have to turn their mind to now, you know, and I can actually understand why as well, because there's a lot of amazing people in the entire rest of the planet, but what about families here that have lived here that are part of the fabric of this culture in this amazing place? So I think it's going to be slightly eroded, but at the same time, you know, there's still a lot of jobs. People underestimate how hard it is to get a job in Dubai.
That's true. I guess I kind of feel a little bit different to Chris. I think growth is just going to continue from an expat perspective. And I feel like they know this, you know, they've started talking about building bigger roads and new motorways because they know the expat community is just going to get bigger and bigger. The bigger companies are coming here. I think you've definitely got a valid point, but I do think the expat community is just going to grow even more than it has done.
I get at least five approaches every day from people saying, Chris, I want to move to Dubai. Can you find me a job? And I'm not joking.
I can believe it.
A volume of people. And I think what I generally have to say to them is, you know, there are jobs and it is growing, but a lot of the people who are here, you know, have already got visas, and it's not as fluid in terms of movement.
I think both responses, Neil, have got validity to them.
Well, who knows? You might be looking for a new CEO. Yeah.
If he goes down his professor. You heard it here first.
That's the idea.
There you go.
No, there's definitely been an influx. I mean, even looking at the membership for the British Business Group of the last year, there's been 30% of those new members are new to the UAE in the last year. So yeah, my LinkedIn inbox is not as busy, but I also see a lot of interest, but it's for lifestyle, like for the reasons you said, you moved over across lifestyle, then job. But what I think what you're saying and what everyone's advice would be is get the job first before you land. I mean, even sort of 36 years ago when BBG was founded, it really was people arriving with a suitcase and a briefcase, and it was the land of opportunity. But now I would definitely exercise caution in coming here to make sure that you've got that set up, because it's becomes a very expensive place to live when there isn't an income, and you don't want to land a job just for the sake of the salary either. And on that note, do you see a lot of movement once you've placed people, or do they tend to stay in those roles, or are you seeing, compared to London, people move around more?
People stay. Yeah, it's much less fluid than London or New York or, you know, any of the other places that we recruit in. And I think it's the visa thing, Katie.
I was going to agree. It's definitely the visa.
Yeah.
You're at risk. You know, if you don't have that visa, you could be going home.
Yeah, and there's a lot at risk. You know, when people have got kids in schools and have paid those checks that Amanda spoke about for the next year of rent, you know, it's people want to hold on to what they've got.
Things have definitely changed in the last 18 months. So you've got a grace period now of about 6 months where if you were to lose your job and you've got that without having to do border runs, which I remember 12 years ago was the case, and also the golden visa.
Yeah.
And that makes people a lot more independent, and also the entrepreneurial visas. So I think that was the real turning point really for seeing so many people coming to Dubai was that independence of the working visa.
When we moved here, we used a company to help us with all of the advice and visas and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, as we learned more, I thought there are things that I wish they'd have told us. But I am very grateful for the fact that we had them, because it did help to expedite a whole horizon of things that we had to deal with. When we decided on January 1st, 2021, that we were moving literally over breakfast, New Year's Day, by April, we were here. As how quickly it happened.
So you just opened a can of worms there. You wish they had told you. Tell us more.
I think I wish we'd have known more about different trading licenses and different trading zones. I totally didn't appreciate that there's over 50 regions within Dubai that have got their own characteristics, stipulations, and can be more or less appealing depending on what your nature of trade is. I wish I'd have known more about different banks and processes with banks. Some of them are quite antiquated when it comes to the need to physically be there to do stuff. That was mind-blowing for me. And now I'm aware of the fact that I didn't actually have to do that. And I could have gone with other banks where everything's much more digitally facilitated. You had a funny story about the Diwa, didn't you?
I just feel like you don't really know what you're walking into, and then you have to go here and you have to pay the check to this person and you have to go to this hole in the wall and then you have to do... It was quite complicated.
But for people who are maybe not in the UAE listening to this and listening to it, a DUI is Department of Water and Electricity. And, you know, to get that, you, first of all, you've got to have gone through a number of other things. To get, you know, your rent and
a jarry.
So there's all of these things you've got to do, and that was the final thing really for me, is that you can't really do a lot in parallel. Everything's got to be sequential, and I think certainly in the UK we're used to being able to run different processes independently with different governing bodies and people that you need stuff from. I didn't feel like it was as like that when we moved here. Things have to be done in a certain order and things have to be stamped.
Lots of printing, lots of
prints.
Although there's huge moves to making it e-friendly, so lots of online. And it's interesting as well, when we first moved over here 12 years ago, a great piece of advice I had was, yes, get the inbound contract ready, but also already think about leaving. So it's not, I mean, once you hear, I mean, everyone says they're going to be here for 2 or 3 years and they stay for longer. It's kind of everyone you meet says that.
Yeah.
But that's always something to have in the back of the mind, is preparing for how to unpick life in Dubai, because it's basically the reverse of what you've gone through to in landing. So it's making sure that process is in place, and yeah, having a guide really helps.
Have you heard about the shorts, the issue with shorts? If you're going to get a stamp, maybe a jari or visa, can't remember. Friend went with shorts and he couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
And they told him to go back and get trousers. And unfortunately, he went at 8 a.m. So all the shops are shut. And he had to wait until 9 or 10 for Brands for Less to open, because he wanted to get the cheapest trousers.
It's a government office, right? So you need to be respectful of the fact that that's the etiquette.
Exactly.
I remember going.
If you're getting a stamp, just make sure you wear trousers. With that note, just a last question around, in the pre-interview, you talked about your challenges around, and you've run many businesses, you have businesses, you've sold businesses, and you talked about this challenge around the transactional trap. And I thought that was really interesting. So it's something you've avoided for this business, but for the audience, could you just elaborate?
Yeah, and I think it's really important, particularly when you look through this topic, through the lens of Dubai, where relationships are super important. You know, we work in a sector in recruitment where the way a lot of our competitive horizon operates is very transactional. You know, get a job or spot a job, find a CV, send it, done. Right? And that's fine. There's a lot of people that make a lot of money out of doing that. But I actually think here you need to be really aware of the transactional trap, because if you fall into that mode, I actually feel like it's like sinking sand, excuse the pun. You know, it's really hard to get out of it. You need to be consultative. You need to be relationship orientated. And the nucleus of both of those things is value. How am I doing or creating or saying something that creates value for you? If you're not intimate with what your value proposition is, very, very hard to avoid being transactional. You can sell anything without value. Now, it's on the shelf. People take it or leave it. But if you're going to sell here and you're going to do so successfully and sustainably, I think you need to be value orientated and you need to desperately avoid being transactional.
Love it. What a great way to end. So thanks, Chris. Thanks, Amanda, for the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been great.
And thank you
as well. Thanks for listening to the Don't Do That, Do This podcast.